This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Is there something you're aching to get off your chest? It's not healthy to keep it bottled up inside. Don't cling too tightly to your secrets, regrets, struggles, and resentments. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and work through whatever is weighing you down. It's also a great way to learn to resolve conflict, change negative thought patterns, and more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/heartwisdom today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/heartwisdom.
Loving kindness is said is like the rain that falls on all things, the just and the unjust, equally without discrimination. That love, when it grows within our heart, has a quality of nurturance and moisture and opening and sweetness and constancy to it. It's really an expression of the heart that's unencumbered by fear.
Luminous, says the Buddha, is this heart and mind. Welcome to Heart Wisdom, Jack Kornfield's podcast on the Be Here Now Network. I'm Ganesh, welcoming you to episode 231, The Divine Abodes, Navigating the World from the Goodness of Our Hearts. This episode is all about Buddhism's Brahma Viharas, the abodes of the gods. But rather than exploring these as these highfalutin Buddhist concepts, Jack really brings it down to earth, illuminating the divine abodes as qualities of the awakened heart. Loving kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity. This episode is chock full of amazing stories involving his Buddhist teacher Mahagosananda, and the power of mirror neurons for sharing awakened states of consciousness with each other. There's a story of Sharon Salzberg and how metta practice and intention can literally change the world around you as it reflects back to you. And then some nice bits on Ram Dass and the power of the loving heart. And before we dive into the episode, I just want to share with you all what Jack has coming up. It's quite a bit, and these are really cool opportunities to connect in with Jack virtually. On the morning of March 29th, Jack will be taking part in a live stream called From Psychedelics to Mindfulness. This is presented by Banyan and will be with Louis Schwartzberg, the amazing director of Fantastic Fungi. On April 2nd, Jack will be taking part in a live stream called The Gift of Ram Dass. This is a free virtual gathering hosted by LoveServe Remember, honoring Ram Dass's life and teachings and sharing how we can apply those to our daily life. And here's a really cool and unique offering. Jack has recently teamed up with Dr. Dan Siegel, who I'm sure you know from various podcasts here on the Be Here Now Network, to create a course that is going to start on April 15th called Living Beautifully, Transformative Science and Mindfulness Practices to Cultivate a Wise Heart. This course will contain 11 hours of evergreen modules, along with two live question and answer sessions if you sign up before April 15th. This means April 15th, we have a nice Jack doubleheader, as that Monday is the Monday night Dharma talk and meditation for the month of April, hosted by Spirit Rock. This is truly the guru bead on the mala for keeping in touch with Jack's teachings, and is pay what you can, so we hope to see you there. And last, but certainly not least, April 19th starts the next session of the Power of Awareness 7-week training on mindfulness and compassion, which Jack does with Tara Brock, Devin Berry, and Conda Mason. This is one of the premier mindfulness trainings, so I implore you to check that out. All of these events and courses can be found on jackcornfield.com. You can get there through the link in the show notes. So there we go. All the housekeeping is wrapped up, so we can cozy up to episode 231, The Divine Abodes, Navigating the World from the Goodness of Our Hearts. I will leave you with the quote that I began this monologue with. Luminous, says the Buddha, is this heart and mind. Namaste.
The Buddhist texts begin, some of the Buddhist texts, with this wonderful greeting, O nobly born, O you who are the sons and daughters of the awakened ones, of the Buddhas, remember who you really are. Remember your capacity to love, to open, to care for this life, this incarnation that you've been born into, to see what's possible of beauty that is true for your own heart and to bring it to flower. Now, I had a friend who used to come and sit here at Spirit Rock. I haven't seen him for quite a few years. His name is Milton Friedman, the same as a very famous, perhaps Nobel Prize winning, I'm pretty sure, economist from the University of Chicago. And this fellow, Milton Friedman, my friend, was a speechwriter in Washington. He worked for a number of senators, and he was also a speechwriter in the White House, I think during Jimmy Carter's administration. And it was during Jimmy Carter's administration, there was some great financial difficulties in the markets. Inflation was really high. And my friend Milton Friedman was working at the White House at that time. And one day he got a call from the treasurer and financial director of this huge umbrella organization from one of the largest church groups in America. And this person called and said, is this Milton Friedman? And he said, it is. And he said, listen, I want to introduce myself, and I work for this huge umbrella organization, you know, the finances of these churches in America. And it's really tough economically out there, and I don't quite know what to do, and we have these billions of dollars that we have to invest in the right way and so forth. And do you have any suggestions for us? And my friend Milton Friedman said, have you considered giving it to the poor? To which the person on the other end of the line, with kind of a shocked voice, said, is this the real Milton Friedman? And my friend Milton replied, is this the real church? He had a good mind, Milton. He had good wit. But it really is a question for our time. Here we are, and it's not just, I mean, that dialogue is funny, you know, but there's also some deeper truth in it. What is possible for us as human beings, not for the Buddha in India, but the Buddha within ourselves? What is the awakened heart? And what the Buddhist teachings and meditation and all the things that I have studied and learned point to is that we each have a capacity for love and compassion, generosity, forgiveness. We each have within this life that we've been given these wonderful qualities. Luminous, says the Buddha, is this heart and mind. When we look into it, when we're not lost in the small sense of self or the body of fear, you know what I mean by that, that place where you get frightened and contracted and so forth. When we're not identified in that way and we remember who we really are born into this human incarnation for a time, what matters and what's possible for us? And in some way we can develop these qualities, but in another more fundamental way, they are our true nature. And when the stuff that gets in the way of them is released, they shine. My inspiration in many ways in this, one of the teachers that I studied with for a long time, was the Cambodian monk named Gosananda, Mahagosananda, who was this great Buddhist scholar. I met him. We lived together in forest monasteries in Thailand during the Cambodian Holocaust, when almost a third of the people in Cambodia were killed, including 18 of the 20 people in his extended family, and 57,000 of the 60,000 monks and nuns, and this great kind of Khmer Rouge communist purge of everyone who was educated to start anew. And he was unlike many of the great spiritual masters of Asia that I studied with. He didn't make big temples, although there were dozens and dozens of temples that functioned in his name. But he didn't stay there. And this is a, he died this year, and this was a really beautiful obituary in The Economist magazine. Said he didn't stay at his temples, even though they honored him. He would be far away walking, and where he walked was often remote, neither safe nor quiet. He would tread, a little bird-like man with hands folded and head bowed, along the narrow paths that threaded through the jungle forests of central Cambodia. Care was necessary, for the ground had been sown with landmines up to the edge of the trail. And he would walk, and he did this for 15 years through the war zones, bringing people back to their villages who were refugees, chanting loving kindness the whole way. And sometimes they'd be shot at, and grenades would be sent and, you know, thrown at them and so forth, and they would stop and do some more chanting. And, you know, he was an amazing person. He spoke 15 languages. He was a polymath, a great intellectual and scholar. But that wasn't what mattered to him. What mattered was love. And wherever he went, he would hand out tens of thousands of copies of the Sutra on Loving Kindness from the Buddha. On his walks, the message remained the same. There was no complication. The work, he said, would be slow. Step by loving step, as he liked to say, and it would continue as long as the Cambodians felt divided from each other and brutalized by their past. After 1980, he was made much of. He represented the Cambodian government in exile at the United Nations, was influential in the peace talks. He was made the Supreme Patriarch of all of Cambodia. Several times he was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. He founded more than 50 temples around the world. Sometimes he spoke there, but his first priority lay elsewhere. It was to appear bird-like out of the Cambodian forest, to surprise a man digging or a woman washing, to remind them that the power of love was stronger than the forces of history, and then to move on, to chant to them, hatred never ends by hatred, but by love alone is healed. This is the ancient and eternal law. And he would chant this over and over to people whose hearts were broken and lives were torn apart, and say, this is the only way you can redeem yourself and redeem your children and redeem this land. And what was beautiful about being with Gosananda is that he didn't feel like that was special or unique to him, or that you had to be some great person to do it. Everybody he met, he talked to in the same straightforward, simple way, and said, you know, love is possible for you. It really is. And you'd hear him and you'd believe it. You could feel it. I think it's the, you know, neurologically, it's the mirror neurons, if you want to study modern neuroscience, that actually reflect when we are in the presence of another, our whole nervous system actually picks up what's happening with that other person. So the divine abodes, says the Buddha, the abodes of the gods, is the literal translation, but really it's the awakened heart, or loving kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity or peace. And loving kindness, I'll go through them each tonight for a bit. Loving kindness is said is like the rain that falls on all things, the just and the unjust, equally without discrimination. That love, when it grows within our heart, has a quality of nurturance and moisture and opening and sweetness and constancy to it. It's really an expression of the heart that's unencumbered by fear. And when the Buddha first taught loving kindness, in the old stories as a meditation practice. It was because some of his early monks and nuns went off to meditate in these caves in a deep, dark forest and got quite frightened by the wild animals and the spirits or ghosts or whatever and came running back and saying, it's too scary to practice there. We need some protection practice. And the Buddha said, I will give you the great protection. And this great protection was the teachings and the offering of loving kindness for all beings. Put away all encumbrances of heart, all fears, and let your heart full of love pervade one quarter of the world, and so too the second, and the third, and the fourth, the whole world above, below, and around, pervade and extend a love-filled thought and feeling, abounding, sublime, beyond measure, free from hatred and ill will, blessing all that it touches. And there's this whole long systematic practice. And if you do it, it's for crawling things and thick and thin things and beings far and near and all males and all females and those who are known and unknown and beings with no legs and two legs and four legs and many legs and beings to the north and the south and the east and the west and those who are young and those who are old and those who are suffering and those who are causing suffering. They need the love, too, to be reawakened. And those who are happy and those who are causing happiness. Every single being. And you feel it when you go in the monasteries, like the forest monasteries. I love this little poem. A bug crawls over the paper. Leave him be. We need all the readers we can get. You know, this is from Lloyd Reynolds, a great master calligrapher in America. There is this sensitivity to life itself that every being is worthy of love or respect. And so it was taught in this formal practice when there was the sense of danger. But our knowing about love ennobles us. It allows us to touch what we have, allows us to touch with love what we have touched with fear. Because that's really the opposite of love, is fear. And you know it because we're in this time in our culture right now where there's a lot of fear-mongering in all kinds of ways. Immigration or, you know, Muslims or all this kind of stuff that's completely designed somehow to scare you as if it were true. The approach of love and respect, says Martin Luther King, does not immediately change the heart of the oppressor. It first does something to the hearts and souls of those committed to it. It gives them new self-respect. It calls up resources of strength and courage that they did not know that they had. And when it finally reaches their opponents, it so stirs their conscience that reconciliation becomes a reality. There's something not only beautiful but powerful and ennobling when we trust more and more the spirit of love. Beside with, in the end, when you look really what matters, if you ask somebody at the end of life, you have the privilege to be with someone who's dying consciously, the questions people ask are really very simple ones, not very many. Did I love well? Did I love this life and what was given to me? Maybe did I live fully in some way? Did I give myself to it? Those kind of questions are all that really matters. And then people say, well, okay, it's nice to hear about this, but it's not very easy, as that, you know, first poem said. You know, what about the people around you? And that's why, in addition to the understanding that we each have this great capacity to love within us, every one of us, that also there are practices to reawaken it. So this story, my friend Sharon Salzberg, colleague, was teaching a day of metta, loving kindness practice, in Oakland at Jerry Brown's We the People. She said, I try to have participants do walking meditation on the city streets so they can practice their loving kindness with whoever comes by. One woman was having a big struggle with this loving kindness practice. It felt so dry, no warm feelings would come and she wanted them. And I told her it was more like planting seeds. You just plant seeds and you trust something will grow. During the next walking period, she chose to walk on the train platform across the street at Jack London Station. As she did, a train pulled in. She tried her metta. One of the people who got off was a man in a suit, obviously hurried, distracted, unaware. She noticed herself judging him. He looked so uptight. Then she judged herself. See, I'm just no good at this loving-kindness stuff. But she took a breath and continued wishing him well. And then he walked down the long train platform right up to her and said, "Excuse me, ma'am, this may sound strange. I've never done this before in my life, but I'm facing a really bad situation, and you seem to be such a kind and peaceful person, and I'd just like to ask if you would pray for me." And she did. So there's something that we know in modern psychology, but was known in ancient psychology, the Buddha, and really is innate to us, that where we turn our attention to what we give our attention, that place will flower, will blossom, will grow. And if we give our attention to love, it grows. If we practice it, we remind ourselves and our capacity becomes stronger. And it's not that you won't have setbacks like that woman and feel that it's difficult. And, you know, sometimes the closer it gets to us, the more difficult. I mean, I remember this Jules Pfeiffer cartoon where there's a man standing with his arms crossed like this in the corner, kind of pulled back in the corner, and a woman on her knees with her arms outstretched saying, "But I love you." And his comment is, "Don't you threaten me," you know. If there's no enemy within, it says in the Dhammapada, then the enemy outside can do us no real harm. And it's an amazing thing to walk through the world as Mahagosananda did, feeling the stream of love, the possibility of love, the connection of love. And there are all these blessings if one does the practice of loving kindness. It said you fall asleep easily and you waken contented and people will love you and angels and devas will love you. And there's a whole great list of things. Animals will love you as you grow, but elephants will bow to you slightly as you go by. Says it, I don't know. You could try it in the zoo, something like that, see if it works. But, you know, you can try it. I had a friend who started to do hospice work. She was doing hospice work, and she started to just really, really fall in love with the people she was working with who were dying. And I said to her, "Do you think that's because they're so vulnerable and open and you make such a deep connection?" She said, "Yeah, but I don't think that's the real reason." She said, "That's a piece of it." She said, "But because I think what really is happening is that I do metta practice for them several times a day, even when I'm not with them. I think of them there and people I'm tending who are near the end of life. And I just see them in that way. And so I go back there and we don't even have to say anything. I enter the room and it just kind of lights up because I've learned to love them." And there's this beautiful capacity that you have, that each person has, to make your heart a war-free zone. You know, I mean, we look at all the politics and all that stuff. This is the place that it starts, with this very simple intention to cultivate the garden of the heart. Oscar Wilde says, "Who being loved is poor?" So a Christmas story for you. Our meal came. Oh, no, wrong page. Here we go. It was Sunday, Christmas. Our family had spent the holiday in San Francisco with my husband's parents. In order for us to be back at work on Monday, we found ourselves driving the 400 miles home to Los Angeles during Christmas Day. It was normally an 8-hour drive, but with kids it can be 14-hour endurance test. When we could stand it no longer, we stopped for lunch in King City, a little metropolis of 6 gas stations. And it was into one of the 3 diners there that the four of us trooped, road-weary, saddle-sore. As I sat Eric, our one-year-old, in a high chair, I looked around the room. The restaurant was nearly empty. We were the only family, and ours were the only children. Everybody else was busy eating, talking quietly, aware perhaps that we were all somehow out of place on this special day. My reverie was interrupted when I heard Eric squeal with glee, "Hi there!" He pounded his fat baby hands whack, whack on the metal high chair tray. "Hi there!" His face was alive with excitement, eyes wide, gums bared in a toothless grin. He wriggled and chirped, and then I saw the source of his merriment, and my eyes could not take it in all at once. A tattered rag of a coat, dirty, greasy, and worn, baggy pants, a spindly body, toes that poked out of old shoes, and a face like none other, gums as bare as Eric, hair uncombed, unwashed, unbearable, whiskers too short to be called a beard. I was too far away to smell him, but I knew he smelled, and his hands were waving in the air, flapping about on loose wrists. "Hi there, baby. Hi there, big boy. I see you, Buster." My husband and I exchanged a look that was a cross between "What do we do?" and "Poor devil." Eric continued to laugh and answer, "Hi there, hi there." Every call was echoed. I noticed the waitress's eyebrows shoot to their foreheads. Several people nearby, This old geezer was creating a nuisance with my beautiful baby. I shoved a cracker at Eric, and he pulverized it on the tray. I whispered, "Why me?" under my breath. Been a long day. Our meal came, and the nuisance continued. Now the old bum was shouting from across the room, "Do you know patty cake? Attaboy! Do you know peekaboo? Hey, look, he knows peekaboo." Nobody else thought it was cute. The guy was probably drunk and a definite disturbance, and I was embarrassed. My husband was humiliated. Even our six-year-old said, "Why is that old man talking so loud?" We ate in silence, except Eric, who was running through his repertoire for the admiring applause of a Skid Row bum. Finally, I had enough. I turned the high chair. Eric screamed and clamored around to face his old buddy. Now I was really mad. Dennis went to pay the check, imploring me to get Eric and meet me in the parking lot. So I trundled Eric out of the high chair and looked toward the exit. The old man sat poised and waiting, his chair directly between me and the door. "Lord, just let me get out of here before he speaks to me or my baby," and I headed toward the door. It soon became apparent that both the Lord and Eric had other plans. As I drew closer to the man, I turned my back, walking to sidestep him. And as I did so, Eric, all the while with his eyes riveted on his new best friend, leaned far over my arm, reaching with both arms in the baby's pick-me-up position. In a split second of balancing my baby and turning to counter his weight, I came eye to eye with the old man. Eric was lunging for him, arms spread wide. The bum's eyes both asked and implored, "Would you let me hold your baby?" There was no need for me to answer, since Eric propelled himself from my arms to the man's. And suddenly a very old man and a very young baby were involved in a love relationship. Eric laid his tiny head upon the man's ragged shoulder, and the man's eyes closed, and I saw tears hover beneath his lashes. His aged hands, full of grime and pain and hard labor, gently, so gently cradled my baby's bottom and stroked his back. The old man rocked and cradled Eric in his arms for a moment, and then his eyes opened and set squarely on mine. He said in a firm, commanding voice, "Now you take proper care of this baby." And somehow I managed, "I will," from a throat that contained a stone. He pried Eric from his chest, unwillingly, longingly, as though he were in pain. And I held my arms open to receive my baby, and again the gentleman addressed me. "God bless you, ma'am. You've given me my Christmas." I said nothing more than a muttered thanks. With Eric in my arms, I ran for the car. Dennis wondered why I was crying and holding Eric so tightly and why I was saying, "My God, don't let me forget. Please don't let me forget." So it's an amazing thing when we can touch what we've touched with fear, with love. And it's possible. Doesn't mean that you have to put yourself at risk in the world. or be foolish. I don't mean that. But that's really different than love. That's just being discriminating and taking care of the circumstances of your life. But to love is a power that's really unshakable and unstoppable. And as Meher Baba said, it's not for the faint-hearted, but it's there for you. And what the teachings of the Buddha offer to us is this wonderful reminder that it is our birthright and that we can offer it to ourselves, which is a huge thing and many people have a lot of trouble with. Well-wishing of love for yourself. All the kind of unworthiness and self-hatred in our culture and judgment. And we can offer it to one another and practice it. To me, that's the power of one person, of Gandhi or Buddha or Christ, one clear person who isn't vulnerable. This is Ram Dass. Don't underestimate the power of the human heart. When I look at the human heart, that link, that doorway of love, I see an institution that makes the Pentagon look like children's toys. And it is, because it's really like gravity. It's that which connects us all. It's the fundamental web of life. And when we meditate, we quiet the mind and we open the heart and we remember what we're here for and who we are. And it's just that simple. And, you know, the best place to learn love, of course, is things that are difficult. That's where you learn anything, pretty much. To love your crooked neighbor, says Auden, the poet, W.H. Auden, to love your crooked neighbor with your own crooked heart. That was his line. You know, and then everything lightens up. It does. And when you do the systematic metta practice, which we've done here many nights and so forth, you start with easy people and people you love and that which opens your heart, and then, you know, friends and then neutral people. And gradually you learn to include difficult people, not even because you like them that much. You may hate them maybe still, but it's okay. But because the minute you picture them and you're doing your loving kindness, your heart closes. It shrivels up. I hate that person. I'm never going to love them. Not somebody like that, you know. And then you realize it's just not worth it. It's too painful to close your heart. And so you say, okay, even you, I'll love a little bit, you know. And then you realize you can do it. And it changes, not only does it change you, but it changes your world.